You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Now, this show works as a standalone interview, but I have spoken to Sarah Millican before, and if you'd like to, you can look back in the archive at episode number 7. I think some of the earlier shows briefly slipped off iTunes, but they're all back up there now. If you haven't already heard show number 7 with Sarah Millican, then now's a good time to do so. Or you can just jump right in now with this one, recorded live at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh in 2013. Here's Sarah Millican. Thank you,
Hello.
Sarah. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Hello to you. How was your 5 minutes hiding in the curtain there?
Well, I sat down for a bit and then I realised it would give me baggy knees on my leggings. So I stood up really quickly, but they're still baggy, but it's fine.
Okay, good.
I shouldn't have drawn attention to it.
But now the front row are checking them
they're
out.
They're all looking.
They don't look too baggy.
They're also covered in cat hair. Oh my God. My leggings are exactly what I am. Baggy and covered in cat hair.
You are covered in cat hair because you've just driven here from your house.
Yeah.
Because you are doing a weird version of the Edinburgh Festival where you treat it as a sort of jolly and turn up and do 3 or 4 nights. Is that right?
It's not a jolly. Shut your face. I go home on Sunday nights and for 36 hours and it's a 4-hour drive each way.
Okay.
And I get to cuddle my cats and sit in my house in the quiet where there are no flyers. Exactly. See, these you're people, all like, we get you.
These people can't even imagine such a thing as no flyers.
It's lovely. It's really nice. It's tiring, but it's totally worth it.
Sure. And you're performing at The Stand this year?
Yeah.
Is that you? This is your first time at The Stand?
No, second time at The Stand.
Okay.
Yeah, I was at The Stand on my third solo show.
Okay.
And this is my fifth.
I spoke to a mutual friend of ours who will currently remain nameless about their recent move from one of the big 4 or 5 venues to The Stand. And they said it was like leaving an abusive relationship for a more positive relationship at The Stand. And only then did you realise that you'd been being abused.
Wow, that's harsh.
That's quite
it?
Harsh, isn't it? But The Stand are well known for being like they're the only.
They're very cuddly.
They're a year round comedy club.
Yes.
And they give, I believe, a much more preferential deal to comics. Is that what were your reasons for going to The Stand rather than the bigger venues?
Well, because I have not really been loyal to anybody. I've just hoard myself
Revelation
around.
Number one, ladies and gentlemen.
I was at the Pleasance for my first year in the Hut, and then my second year at the Pleasance courtyard beside, and then at the Stand, and then at the Assembly Hall and the Mound, and then back at the Stand. So I'm not one of the main reasons, because I'd already done that room, and I've done that room a million times because obviously we work there on weekends and stuff as well all the rest of the year, and because I wanted a fringe, I didn't want to do a big room suits some people, and I get to do it on tour, and that's great, and I love that. But I just thought, well, I want a fringe. I want a little room that's, you know, low ceiling and just 150 people. So that's what we decided to do. And I stupidly wanted a relatively early time slot for me so that I could go out and see other shows and things as well. I was entirely selfish this year. I'm having a lovely time.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you're selfish. It's great.
And is there an element to which you being at The Stand and being in that smaller comedy club, is that because you're sort of peripherally aware that there is an occasional thing that happens or a frequent thing that happens at the fringe whereby
comics with massive TV profile come and do a huge venue for loads and loads of nights, and there's a sort of a sense among the rest of the comedians that you're like, oh, come on, mate, if you can sell out McEwen Hall twice a night for the entire month, that's taking up quite a lot of
Punters. I think if you can sell a 1,200 seater in September, then you should do it in September and then leave the audience to everybody else in August, I think. I did a 700 seater the last time I was here. I did the Assembly Hall of them, I did 700. I did 17 nights because I didn't think I could sell out. So I did 17 nights, and Milton Jones did the same slot for the first week. So I did the second 2.5 weeks. And then we put on extra shows at the EICC, four extra shows at the EICC, which is 1,200.
Yeah.
And I remember selling out, like, amazing, 17 nights at 700. And then we put on extra shows. And then I was back to, oh, shit, what if I don't sell these out? And it's terrifying. And then just a churny belly constantly.
So it still has that effect on you?
Yeah, always,
even when
until the last one is gone.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, always feel sick.
And do you check
sales
up along the way? Do you go, okay, how is it selling today?
I always know. I've always, from day one of doing my first Fringe, I've always known how many I was going into. So my first, when I was at the Hut, my first year, I had 5 in my first show. And don't laugh, that's really good.
Yeah, that is double the average Edinburgh audience, isn't it?
That's very much I was doing all right. And I had 5, and I knew 3 of them. shut up. But I still saw it. But if you walk out into an audience, I don't know if you need to know. I need to know how many I've got in. Because if I walk out and there's 5 in, and I know there's 5 in, then I can go out and have a lovely time. But if I walk out and think there's 25 in and there's only 5, it does make you feel a bit sick.
You don't want your first beat on stage to be, oh
exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, the way I saw it, those 5 people on the first night of my first show took a punt. Mm-hmm. And there was 5, because they'd all paid, even the 3 that knew me, they still had paid. And I still thought, it's 7, thanks. I'm not stupid. 7:30 was my first show time, and I still found it incredibly flattering. If you look through the whole brochure, that at 7:30 on that first night, 5 people picked me, and that's how I played the room, and that's how you should do it, I think. You don't, never look at the empty seats, you look at the people who've gone, that's what I'm doing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
The show, not me.
Yeah.
Well, maybe one or two of you.
I think, and I don't know if this is just because we go back a bit and I know you fairly well, but you do seem, amongst a lot of comics that I've spoken to on this show and sort of generally, you do seem, for someone that is doing as phenomenally well as you are, to still be really grounded in what's important to the Fringe, what's important to other comedians, what's important to audiences.
Well, because if you lose that, then you're taking the mick, really. And also, I think I've been on the receiving end. So I remember there was a huge show on, somebody who will remain nameless, but a huge venue on the night, one of the nights during my first Fringe. And I remember me and all of my friends, probably you included, had next to nobody in because they decided to do 10,000 maybe.
I've just worked out who that
okay.
was. Yeah.
And I don't think that's the way people should be, but I don't think that's the way the Fringe should be.
Sure. Okay. So it's important to you to have that kind of face-to-face contact with your audience. Like, do you prefer playing a room like The Stand where you can actually see the front row and you're that far away from them to a stage when you're miles away and they're a long
They're totally different. They're totally different. I like Hammersmith Apollo. It's ridiculous to walk out onto the stage at Hammersmith Apollo and see 3,500 people. That feels ridiculous and feels very flattering. But it's a different gig. Like on my first tour, we got up to doing sort of 1,000 seaters, and then I'd had to rebook one because of the snow, and it was in a 90 seater, and it was really odd. It was in the Ustinov studio in Bath, and it was very odd to have done 1,000 seaters and then go to a 90, and it was just different. I like them both equally, they're just different. But I just thought, because I was doing the big venues on tour, because we're doing good big theatres, that it would be nice to do, you know, where I could see the whites of their eyes. But also, it does have added danger, because sometimes I have a bit of a dicky tummy before a show, and at The Stand, you could totally fart and they could smell it.
Yeah.
Because they're so close to you. Way in a theatre, they would never know.
So, and would you do arenas? Is it a decision not to?
No,
is it based just purely on?
I don't want to do arenas. I don't. It suits some people. It suits some people who are physical. And I don't even take the mic out the stand. I mean, you're flattered that I'm even doing that now. I normally leave the mic at the stand. It's not for me. I've seen some comedy in arenas, and I just think I'm watching the screen. I might as well buy the DVD. And it suits some people, but it's not for me. And especially given the fact that I don't move at all. If you're running around the stage, then I can say there is a benefit.
You're not one of those lunging comedians, are you?
I don't want lunch. No, I just think I'd worry that I wouldn't get up again.
So you mentioned, okay, this is me bridging to something you said a moment ago about farting on stage. Now, okay. What that reminds me is that, and this is good, this isn't necessarily going where you think it is, but do you think that there is a portion of your audience that comes to see you based on your kind of public persona rather than your club gigs, who come to see you and are affected by your use of, I mean, farting wasn't a great example, but do you know what I mean? You will happily swear on stage. You'll happily do fairly graphic sexual material. And do you feel that there are some people out there who are going, oh, I didn't know it was going to be like this?
Yeah, I think there probably are. Not as many as you'd think, though, because I think my telly persona is quite close to my onstage persona. Because I think, especially with the TV series, we get away with being quite rude because it's 10 o'clock and because I look like this. They're like, she's not going to be rude. Oh, she's got a flowery dress on. She's not going to be rude. So I get away with quite a lot. And I think even on panel shows, I'm still quite rude and quite sweary, depending on which, if you're on Channel 4, you can, you know, swear as much as you like. So I think there's not that much of a gap. But you do see sometimes, but it's not always, it's not sort of, oh, it's like, oh, like a surprise. Like they weren't expecting it to be that rude and hurrah that it is. That sort of thing. So it's not always disappointed. I mean, maybe they're just keeping themselves to themselves. Those people who are appalled at my use of the C word on occasion. But yeah, I think it's close enough. I think it used to be a lot bigger gap, but since the TV series, that gap's closed up a bit.
Has it been a decision that you've actively made not to clean up your act in search of a wider audience? Because if you look at people like Bill Bailey, for example, who never used any bad language in his set, have you ever sort of considered that? Have you ever thought, oh, actually, that might appeal to more people if I held back on the language?
No. I swear.
I mean, I have to say, it doesn't look like you have.
It's never occurred to me. I do what I think is funny, and people who like it come, and people who don't like it stay away. That's fine. I think if I try, you can't second guess what an audience wants. I don't think you can ever. I think you do what you think is funny, and you try it out, and you try it out, and you take sort of confidence in how many times it works, that sort of thing. But I think if I tried to work out what an audience wanted, I think you're always too late. I think you're better off just doing what you want to do and hoping that people sort of jump on board. So I know, and I, you know, some people think, you know, swearing isn't big or clever, but it's really fun. I love it. I swear all the time. My family swear. I've always been good at swearing. I'm quite good at it.
Yeah.
So why would, you know, if it's a skill you've got, why wouldn't you use it?
And I think there's probably some element as well to which it filters your audience, in that if people have a problem with swearing, do you think they're the sort of people that you probably don't want at your gigs anyway?
Well, I mean, you want an audience who are going to enjoy themselves. And if people are put off by swearing and they've seen me swear on the telly, then they're probably not going to come to the live. So I think whatever you do on the telly should be a representation of what you are live, as close as it possibly be. So if I swear generally in panel shows and things, and they leave it in, which they often do, then that should filter out people who are offended by swearing. Yeah, you don't want anybody, like, I don't mind offending a whole room, I'm happy to do that, but I never want to offend one person. That's awful. It's a rule I've got.
So when I first interviewed you for this show a year and a half ago now, something like that, we talked a lot then about your writing methods, and I don't necessarily want to retread old ground, but for the sake of people who are new to you, I wanted to sort of focus on your persona and how you are on stage, and whether that is a close approximation of you in real life, or whether there are certain differences between you at home and the you that we see on stage, or the you that we're seeing now, even in this kind of half gig situation.
I think the first time I got on stage, I just I had a few rough ideas of what I was going to say, and I said them, and it was things that I was feeling at the time. And I think because I hadn't seen loads of stand-up, I've seen stand-up on the telly before I got up on stage for the first time, but I think those first few gigs and why you decided to do stand-up, because a lot of people do stand-up, we all know this, a lot of people watch loads of stand-up and then they go, oh, I could do better than that. And then they get up and they are sometimes a little bit like their hero until that they shed that skin and become themselves. And I hadn't really seen, I'd seen like two, three stand-up tours. I'd see Jeremy Hardy, Sean Hughes and Jacquardie, and that's all I'd seen. I didn't even know that comedy clubs existed, I don't think. So when I got up on stage, that was just me. It was a polished version of me, but still just me.
And what do you mean by polished? What aspects have
like
you
I wasn't
had you
just
polished
talking off
why?
The top of my head. I had preparation.
Okay. Okay, but so it was you saying stuff that you'd written that you thought would be funny.
Yes.
And so what decisions were those that you'd made about what stuff you would say and what stuff you wouldn't?
I tried to say funny things and try not to say not funny things.
Perfect.
But you don't always know, but you can hazard
sure.
a guess.
Sure. I mean, do you think, would you say...
Sorry, Stu.
No, that's fine. I'm happy to be toyed with. I enjoy that. As you know.
That's good to know for later.
I think, I suppose what I'm getting at is, do you feel that you found your voice early? Is that an idea in comedy that you appreciate,
yeah.
the idea of finding one's voice?
And I think because I didn't have another voice already come, do you know what I mean? I was just
sure.
me, because I didn't have anybody to go, oh, I'm a bit like them, or you know, or anybody to idolise so much that you wrote material that was similar to theirs.
Sure.
Because all it was, I was going through a divorce and I wrote some stuff, sort of helped me get through it, I suppose. And I just thought if a room of people are laughing at this, then that made that easier to deal with. And that's how I started doing it, because I just felt so sort of broken and alone, regardless of the fact that I had good family and friends around me, that when I got up on stage and said, he was a proper dick the other day and had a couple of examples, and people all went, ha ha ha, ha. It was like they were saying, yes, he is a dick. And that was ace. I'm being totally brutally honest.
Yeah, no,
I maybe shouldn't be as brutally honest.
No, that's what I'm after. I read an interview that you did, I think, with The Independent, where you were talking about how you'd seen a counsellor over the time of your divorce. And at one point, you'd said something and she said, oh, that would probably make a good joke.
Yeah.
Was that now? I didn't know. At what point, were you already a comedian by that? By the point
I'd done
that example
happened?
I did a handful
happened? Of gigs.
Okay.
And she knew that. And she had sort of, I think she was quite pleased about what I was doing. She said it wasn't something that she recommended to everybody, just to like, why don't you try doing stand-up comedy? But you see, I wasn't a drinker, and I'm not, what time is it? Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm not a slag. So I'm not a drinker and I'm not a slag. So that's kind of what people often do when they split up with somebody, is they either sleep around or they get drunk a lot. And I didn't have those options, didn't want to do those options. So I got on a stage and told strangers about it. But I think she saw it as, I think she saw how much I was enjoying it and how it was an outlet that
sure.
Was actually quite therapeutic in itself.
Sure.
To sort of get stuff off your chest.
Okay.
But also make, because she once said to me, which I think is the best, probably the best single thing anybody's ever said to me. She said, your textbook, and which might sound like a horrible thing to say to somebody, but basically she was saying that everything that I thought I was the only person that had ever been dumped
sure.
in the world. And she was basically saying that everything you're feeling is normal. And so therefore, to get on a stage and tell stories about that and have people laugh in recognition, mm-hmm. sort of hammering that home that I was just the same as everybody else, which
sure.
is good to hear.
Can you envisage of who you might be if it weren't for stand-up comedy?
If it went for divorce, I'll give you an example, I would still be exactly where I was. I would probably trying to write, because I used to write short plays and things, but that probably would be maybe a small success of getting the odd play on every now and again, because I had a play on and a few short plays on. And I would be in a job I hated, and I would probably be in a flat that was damp, because that's the way we were, and I don't think I would have moved on. I think I needed to hit rock bottom before I
sure.
bounced back up again.
Okay, so with respect to your persona on stage, do you think there are differences between how you behave on stage now and how you behaved when you first started out, and what are those differences?
I still don't know what to do with my hands. Nobody's ever told me. That's why mostly why I keep the mic in the stand, because I'm very, when I talk to people, I'm very I use my hands a lot, whereas when you're holding the mic, and then somebody taught me first early on, hold the mic and then hold the cable with the other hand. Okay, now I know what to do with my hands. And then I did a gig where it was cordless, and I was like, what do I do with my hand? And I find if I keep the mic in the, so that's one example. I'm better with people sort of responding to things. I don't mean laughter, I mean if anybody, and I don't mean heckles, because heckles are always horrible, but I mean if somebody wants to join in a fun way, I'm better with that, because I always used to panic and think, like it was like you were all one person and I'm one person, and if one of you chips in, then I'm not gonna handle this. But then I realised it's only ever one person chipping in, and I've talked to one person loads. I do it all the time. I'm doing it sort of now. So I realised then that so early on that was terrifying, okay. Of not knowing what to do with that, and now I'm better at that. Just things that you experience, sure. And the more you experience them, the better you become at handling them.
Sure, but with regard to your actual personality on stage,
right.
Do you think, I suppose what I'm getting at is, do you find it easier to write jokes now because you know almost the character that you're writing them for?
Yeah, but it's not a character. You know me, this is just me. It's just this. No, I wish there was a character, but that'd be great. And they go, people, oh, you wear those clothes. That must be for fun. No, it's because I like them.
But do you feel more kind of confident in expressing who you are that you can write?
I feel ballsy. I always felt quite ballsy, though. I think just getting up on stage in the first place and talking to people about my divorce when my first 5 minutes, but the first 2.5 minutes were just done to silence.
Your very first gig?
Yeah. I did 5 minutes, first 2.5 minutes, total silence. Then I did a joke about my dad that went from silence to the whole room, just a woof of laughter. And I think other people would think, oh, I never want to do this again. This is terrifying. And my first thought was, well, that bit's got to go to the front. Because the first 2.5 minutes are clearly shit. But I think I know better what works.
Okay.
My hit rate is better than it was in the beginning. So if I try out 10 minutes, in the old days when I tried out 10 minutes of material, I remember doing, to get my 10 to my 20, so instead of doing a 10 minute spot to get 20 minutes of material, I did the Chillingham Arms in Newcastle's new material night that Gavin Webster used to compare. And I did that every Tuesday night for 8 weeks in a row. And I would do like out of 10 minutes that I'd and often written it on the train on the way there, there'd be a minute that worked and was perfect, and then 2 minutes that needed tweaking, 3 minutes that worth having another go at and seeing what I could do with them, and then the rest was dirge. And now I would say if I try out 10 minutes, I would say 7 is there already. And that's just because I know how to write a joke now.
So this is Sarah. Now, obviously, I'm a huge fan of her work and of how much she keeps caring about the circuit and caring about up-and-coming comedians, new comedians. She's just a delightful person, obviously a genuinely excellent comedian, and she really not only cares, but puts the effort in to make that care known and actually have some function in the industry. I think she's not just a great act, but I think I could honestly say she is a great thing to happen to comedy. So we have been a bit top-heavy for male comics on the show recently. I'm aware of that. I've got Susan Kalman and Claudia O'Doherty coming up. Those are already in the can. And plenty more besides in the new year. So we should be getting a rather more even spread soon, which I think is a good thing. I've been enjoying your hashtag #HackSnacks. Remember, you can tweet at ComComPod with the hashtag #HackSnacks and a photo of your depressingly frequent road food when you're gigging or just driving through the night. I know this won't apply to every one of you, but it's kind of fun anyway. Let's have some more of them. And thanks again for your donations. Of course, every little helps with the cost of running the show and recovering from the cost of the live show at Edinburgh. You can donate at comedianscomedian.com by just clicking on the PayPal link and selecting any amount. Any amount you care to donate, completely fine by me. I'm continually stunned by people's generosity and very grateful indeed. You can give me a pound a show, 20 quid for the lot, or just a cheeky fiver and blow me a kiss in the comments box, whatever you like. And if you can't afford anything, that's fine too. Just take a second to rate the show on iTunes, if you please, or simply share your favourite episode with a friend. That's just as important to me. Thank you. Just one additional point on that front, actually, just a technical thing. PayPal seems to have huge problems with setting up regular payments. It gives you a box to tick, and a lot of people have been reporting. I'm getting lots of emails saying people have tried that, and it's not actually working. So best not bother with that. I'll try and get some sort of system set up in due course, because a lot of people have been attempting that or asking about it. Just the regular one-off donations for now, that's fine. Regular, I meant standard, not frequent, but it's up to you. Email me at comedianscomedian.com or tweet me at ComComPod. But for now, let's get back to the brilliant Sarah Millican.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee, Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Do you think that you manage manage in the sense of you make decisions about which elements of you we get to see?
So explain, I don't know what you mean.
Well, like I was going to talk to you about cake.
Okay.
Because I know we spoke to you about this before, that it frustrates you that you're referred to as the comedian that talks about cake.
Yes.
Do you then make decisions about whether or not to do a joke that might involve cake? In your latest show, in Homebird, there's a joke about the biscuit room. There's a joke about the different meals throughout the day, you know, 11s is, which can work at either time, and a Milky Bar, whenever the fuck I like.
Yes.
Those are quite kind of cakey jokes. And did part of you, when you wrote them, did you kind of go, is this sort of playing into the hands of someone else's image of me?
No, because sod them. I try not to, like, if I have to do a 2-minute spot or a 5-minute spot somewhere, I would try not to do cake stuff in that, because you don't want a telly spot for people, because that's the telly is where people see you the most. And I wrote probably about 5 or 6 jokes about cake ever, and they've just appeared on everything. But then, and that's absolutely fine, because it's, you know, it's nice to be known as anything. It could be worse. It could be known as, God, there's lots of things I was known as at school. this is much better. But I try not to do any weight jokes in the show. I don't think, I've got one, but it's more about the response to.
Okay.
The I don't want to spoil it, but so there's one joke that refers to my weight, but not necessarily in a bad way. I've turned that around just because I think the self-deprecation, which is, I'm happy to be self-deprecating, and that's how I always am, and how I am in person. But then I sometimes think, if people are attacking me for one thing, why am I attacking myself as well? That seems a bit ridiculous.
Okay.
And also, I don't think there aren't that many people who look like me, as in sort of a relatively normal shape and aren't wafer thin on the telly. So why am I doing myself down?
Well, this, you in your current show, you do, and I don't remember the exact line, but you sort of have a pop at women's magazines.
Yes.
So what's the actual, what's the bit? Can you just remind us, just for people who aren't?
You didn't use up
the gags, but.
Oh, it's just about the list of things that they expect us to do to ourselves. Sure. And it's all about the physical things, all the different things, all the, you know, sort of.
Okay.
All the, and how women's magazines are fixated on what we look like rather than what we do and what we think,
sure,
and what we believe.
Sure. So like if I on stage do some material about women's magazines, there's a certain amount where there's a certain, and it's not actually genders, maybe myself isn't the best example, but what I mean is, do you have to consider that you might be starting a fight with women's magazines? Because you're so in the public eye, and part of your fame kind of, I imagine there have been articles written about you in women's magazines.
Mm.
Do you have
exclusive ones that I've never spoken to the journalist
on? Yeah, sure. Well, exactly. Exactly. But do you need to, because I have a friend who is quite famous and who said to me that if you, well,
sorry.
Thanks. Another friend, Sarah, I've been cheating on.
I didn't think it was
no,
me.
No, I know. I just quickly made the decision not to name them.
Is it Elton John?
It is Elton John.
Excellent.
So EJ.
Somebody believes him.
EJ and I were chatting. We absolutely weren't. No. What I mean is that there's a female friend of mine who's got quite high profile, and I remember her telling me about if you did, I think her take on it was that if you ever did an OK Magazine At Home With shoot and took the money for that, then the women's magazines regarded you as fair game, because
right.
It's almost like you'd said, I'm playing the game now.
Okay.
Because you'd got money for nothing, for basically being photographed in your house.
Okay.
So that made me think, wow, that's almost quite creepy there, that the journalist might kind of go, if you stick your head above the parapet in a certain way of my own decision, you know, they get to decide what way that is, then they might go, right, we can have a go now. So what is your relationship to women's magazines, do you think, to
so
that
you
area
think that
of the
because
press?
I say I don't really buy them anymore, that they think then that they can have a go at me?
No, I'm just wondering, well, yeah.
Yeah,
call it that. Or do you feel like, would you like to be harsher in your appraisal of them, and you think, oh, if I do that, that might be a problem? Or do you just never
think
about
it? No, I just do what I want, and I think, and they'll do what they want. I think that's the point, is that, you know, some sometimes you do an interview and it goes really well, and it's the same with newspapers. You do an interview, it goes really well, it's really nice, and you read it, and sometimes I read them just to see, and you read them and you go, oh, that's a fair representation of what happened, and sometimes it's not. And sometimes there's an article that's been sort of put together from loads of other articles that you look and you say, I don't remember talking to them, and that's happened. So they do whatever they want. So therefore, I should be able to do whatever I want. And if I don't think me saying that I don't buy women's magazines anymore. Sure. And I'm not saying that they're all, at no point do I say that they're all shit, because they're not. There is the odd one or the odd writer within a magazine that you think, oh, I like what she says or I like what he says. Mm-hmm. But I find when I flick through a magazine, I always feel bad.
Sure.
So why would I do that anymore?
Sure.
So I stopped doing it.
Okay.
So I'm happy to say that. And then if that has repercussions, those repercussions would either be that they do what they want anyway, which is good, they do what they want anyway, which is bad. And
sure.
Regardless, I have no control over it. So at least okay. I get to say my bit.
Sure. Do you think that you are one of the most 100, one of the 100 most powerful women in Britain, as a survey recently said? Have you seen that?
Hour, yes.
Was it Women's Hour? Yeah.
Yes.
You're 1 degree more powerful than the director of Liberty UK, apparently.
Wow,
you're ahead of Shami Chakrabarti on the list.
Doing quite well.
Yeah.
Is it in order? It's not in order.
Oh,
well,
I assumed it was in order.
Oh,
well, it says
I
at the top,
know.
It says number one, the Queen. So I assume the ones after that were in order.
Maybe she demanded that.
Yeah, maybe she did.
Otherwise, she won't come on Woman's Hour.
Or maybe you're all equally powerful. Maybe you're as powerful for the Queen. And if you all gang up together, then there's a...
I'm not on any coins yet, which is disappointing.
Yet, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm 38, though. There's still time. She's really old.
But
although
she has
had a face on coins for a long time.
Do you consider yourself powerful? Do you consider yourself influential? Or is that sort of stuff, is that nonsensical? Or what's your reaction to that?
I think you take it as, it's very flattering. And that's how you take it. I think any polls are, decided by some people that aren't necessarily everybody. So I think, I don't know, it's tricky. I found it flattering. I found it a surprise, but it was flattering. But I still think they're looking at sort of, they're not looking at like sort of MPs so much as, I mean, obviously there were MPs in there as well, but they are looking at different categories of people. And they're looking at people in the public eye who aren't going to be, if you did a list of the 100 most powerful women and you didn't recognise any of them but the Queen, mm-hmm. how much press coverage would that get?
Sure. Okay.
But there would be 199 of, people who are working in all sorts of areas,
sure.
but maybe not necessarily recognisable to the public eye.
Sure. But do you recognise that you have influence? Do you think if you talked about... I tell you why I'm asking this is because I used to do the warm-up for Loose Women, as you know, and you've been a panellist on Loose Women.
Yes.
And I remember thinking
they
to myself...
They loved you.
If so, they
those,
did.
Those older ladies.
We got on well, and later I'll be telling you in what order. No, sorry, that's stuff. I was lazy.
Totally Jane first.
Yeah.
Wants to know now.
Yeah, I know. Just press on. The reason I ask is because I always thought if someone like Jane McDonald, say, stood up and said something public about immigration, it said something positive about immigration. Or said
good,
something
good
positive.
Clarification there.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's another story, which we never mind. But if she said something positive about getting women of a certain age to vote, say, or if she said something political, I think a lot of people would listen to Jane McDonald because they feel they have a relationship with Jane McDonald.
Right.
So people who are in the public eye in a kind of light entertainment way, I think could be perceived to have a sort of influence. Are you aware
yes,
of that? Do you feel any responsibility to involve yourself with the world outside of comedy?
I think my job is to make people laugh. And I think, I don't know. I don't, I'm not very political generally. And maybe I should be more than I am. But I think whoever wants to stand forward and say, I believe this, then all power to them, provided obviously their opinion is a good one. But I don't know
But how do we know which opinion is a good one if you don't participate in it?
You do. I don't know. It doesn't feel very me, but I don't know. Maybe I've only been doing this. It's not long in my career. This is only 8 years, I think. Mm. So I think right now I'm happy with how things are going, but I certainly don't feel a pressure. I have an interesting idea re pressure. I think you have to accept the pressure that's put on you. I don't think if you don't accept it, you don't feel the pressure. So because I get a lot of pressure on me from all different areas, and I just refuse to accept it. And I think that's where madness lies. Mm-hmm. If you take the pressure.
Was it ever problematic being on Loose Women? Were there any problematic elements of how? Again, I'm asking this because a presenter on it, who shall remain nameless, at one point said, I found it really difficult sometimes to work to that audience. Because at one point, one of the presenters said, why aren't we talking about the elephant in the room? This country's full. We should close the borders. And the audience in the room cheered. And I then had to go on and entertain the audience in the room. You know what I mean? Oh, now it's an ad break. Hi, everyone.
I didn't know that.
Okay, I found that very problematic because it seemed to me that there's quite a sort of Daily Mail-ish feel to that show sometimes. Is that anything you ever came across, or is that...
No, because I think if somebody told me that the girls are in like an order, so you've got the host, obviously.
Sure.
And then you've got generally there'll be a soft one. And then you've got a spiky one. And then you've got a mad old aunt. And that's your
everyone
Welsh.
Here has just filled in the gaps, yeah. And you're all correct. You're all correct.
So your Colleen Nolan, your Sally Lindsay, your me was generally sure. On the second after the host.
Sure.
And then you've got your Janet Street Porter, your Carol McGiffin.
Yeah.
And then you've got your Denise Welch and your Sherry Hewson and your Jane McDonald, your slightly mad old aunt on the end. And I think they never in any way, you see, the only time, because we always have a meeting, we used to have a meeting first and you talked about everything. And the only time a subject was ever passed was if we all agreed on something, because that's not a discussion programme. Mm-hmm. So it was better that we had opposing and views. But okay. You were never told what your view was. You always had your own opinion. So okay. I never saw any of that. Or I really liked it. I had a nice time on there. I missed the girls especially. But I really enjoyed it. Well, I must have just done the episodes where it was talking about aren't men rubbish? And
sure.
The stories.
I believe at one point someone said, I think it was Denise Welsh said, yeah, because people are drinking too much water these days, aren't they?
And they're not flashing their boobs enough.
Yeah. Can I ask you, have you seen Bridget Christie's show this
Yes.
year? It's incredible, isn't it?
I love it.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it's really good.
There is a kind of, and you never know whether, particularly when a Fringe is still ongoing, it's easy for columnists or journalists or what have you to kind of pick a thing and go, oh, this year the Fringe is all about this.
Yeah, well, there's got to be an angle, hasn't there?
There's got to be an angle, even if it doesn't necessarily reflect.
You can't just say, wow, all the comics seem to be in really high spirits and having a smashing time.
Yeah, sure.
That doesn't sell newspapers.
Sure. I think what I've heard said about this Fringe is that, oh, this Fringe is all about feminism. It's all about new wave of feminism. Bridget Christie, Nadia Kamel. Do you consider yourself a feminist? Do you have any position on feminism?
Oh, my God, 100%.
Okay.
I'm astonished that any woman who doesn't. I really am. I think I've got quite a feministy vibe in the middle of mine. You're groaning there. There's a lady at the front is groaning at the prospect of somebody being a feminist. Get out. Get the fuck out. I'm astonished why anybody wouldn't want sort of equal rights. I don't know why. Why would anybody? I'm not a feminist. I don't understand. I think Bridget's. I saw Nadia's show as well, and I think it's great. I think that because Bridget's had feminist shows for a few years, mm-hmm. but they've been disguised.
Yes,
and you get it when you're in there, but that's never on the blurb.
Sure.
But this year she's just gone. I'm doing an hour about feminism, and she's selling out a 10 past 11 on a morning, and it's wonderful to see.
Is that anything you could ever see yourself pursuing? Would you be interested in moving beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely an area that's rich and there's plenty of scope for. I think the trick that Bridget has really nailed is dismissing anything that is she feels powerful about but isn't funny. She still made it really funny.
Sure.
And I think that's why she's really nailed that hour,
yeah.
Because every single thing that she says in it, and if she's even found a way of, I don't want to spoil it if anybody's going to say it, but she even found a way of looping in really heavy jokes,
yeah,
a really heavy subject matter, but still by making them funny,
mm-hmm.
without lightening them.
And are you still pushing yourself to find new ways of being funny? Or do you think that you have you've found the way that you're funny and you're happy to keep mining that? Mining that furrow, which is quite wrong.
It's three things I do in this show that I've never done before. I get angry on stage. There's a little bit of music, which I've never done before. And I tell a story that only has a punchline at the end but none throughout, which terrifies me every time.
Sure. That's because the poem story.
Yeah. So there are three. So I think I am sort of, it's almost like I've worked out what I do, but then I'm one room in a house. This is what I do in comedy. But then I'm opening other doors and going, oh, I could do that. Or, and I like the anger on stage, which is the feministy bit, because it's there every night. I feel furious every night. And I've never had that before. And I really like it. It really brings that bit sort of to life, I think.
Okay. Could just on the subject of opening doors and sort of moving on, where can you see your career going next? Now that you're really at the height of your powers, you've got your own TV show, you can do tours, you can come and do fringe shows with the same show or whatever. And knowing you as I do, I'd be amazed if you didn't have some sort of 5-year, 10-year, 15-year plan.
Then you would be amazed. I don't. I want to be consistent, and I want my audience to come back and still... I want every show to be as good or better than the last. And that is the same whether it's TV or stand-up. So it's about consistency. But also I'm trying to be more balanced because I've worked like a bastard for 6 years and with very little time off and very little of anything outside of work. And I'm trying to focus more on a balance now so I can have a little bit of time at home, which I think does actually make you write more and write better, and it makes you a more well-rounded person. And so that when you write jokes, it's not... Because you know it's like sometimes you're just writing jokes about, you know what it's like when you're in a hotel, or you know what it's like when you're stuck in traffic.
Sure.
And most of the audience are going occasionally, but not every day. And you realise that you've done 25 minutes on travel lodges. And you maybe need to, I don't know, see your friends. Sure. That might be nice.
Okay.
I think consistency is what I'm aiming for.
Do you have goals though? Given that a goal of many comedians is to have their own show. Tick. You've done that.
Yeah.
Have you got kind of other kind of long way in the distance kind
I wanna
of goals?
Want to be on a coin. I've sort of done the things that I really wanted to do. So now I think I can afford to be maybe occasionally some more creative. I quite fancy writing a play or that sort of thing.
Okay.
So some things that aren't necessarily big, but I now have a little bit of power behind my name that I could get things made, whereas 6 years ago I couldn't. So it's about keeping myself interested in, so making everything creative, being consistent so that the audience come back and still have a lovely time. And keeping a balance so that I don't go crackers.
Sure.
And getting on a coin. Notes, fuck it, let's do notes.
Yeah.
Five, I'll start small, five.
If it's all right with you, I'd like to open to the floor. If anyone has any questions for Sarah, then feel free to ask them through me. Only for the sake of the recording. I don't mean I'm not going to edit out the naughty bits, but I'll need to repeat them for the recording. What normally happens is there's a slightly eggy moment now where everyone goes, "Oh, have we got to join in?" So I'll ask another question while you're having a think. Do you consider yourself to be an alternative comedian?
That's interesting. I think I'm an alternative because I still think mainstream, as in, 70s. Multiple sort of a bag of jokes that they all shared that none of them wrote, which is what mainstream comedy is to me.
Sure.
But I understand that there's an alternative now, which means that either they're alternative and I am alternative, or they are alternative and I am mainstream, because that other section that I understand to be mainstream does no longer exist. But I think mainstream... It depends on how you look at it. It's not a bad thing to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you say people always would want to be alternative rather than mainstream, wouldn't they? But I'm all right with mainstream. If mainstream means that I get nice smiley audiences, then I don't know. I'm not alternative in... If you look at some of the comics that are up here...
Sure.
That are
you're not challenging your audience, are you? Do you think
I think I am. I don't think it's slop.
No. I'm not, okay. Well, that's. I'm not suggesting that to not challenge them means giving them slop.
It depends what challenging you means. If you.
Go on.
No. I think it's tricky because I enjoy watching alternative. I'm going to call it that.
Sure. People like Tony Law or that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Really,
yeah.
Kind of.
I love him. I love because I love watching either people who can do observational comedy, which is what I would say that I do really, really well. I love watching that. Really just people who are, way out of my league and are amazing at it. or people who do something that I can't do. That's they're the two. That's what I see when I'm up here. Either somebody's doing something amazing, but it's in my sort of area, or somebody who's doing, like Tony Law, somebody who's talking for an hour about something that wouldn't even ever enter my head.
Sure.
I do love watching him, but I don't think that what he does is sort of, it's tricky. I think what he does is brilliant. I think he's an incredibly funny man. He's incredibly creative, but I don't see that I am lesser.
Sure.
Because I do stuff that is more recognisable.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Sure. So would
that make sense?
So absolutely. But would you consider yourself then primarily an artist or an entertainer?
Oh, I see, an artist pays for me. I think.
Nice sidestep.
Well, but I think somebody who calls themselves an artist is also a wanker. So let's say I'm an entertainer then.
What I don't know if the recording will pick up the hooray from the audience there. Excellent. If we do have any questions from the audience, do feel free to put a hand up, and then if you are Sarah, and I'll repeat it. The lady over there. Have you ever considered doing entirely single-sex audiences?
No, and it would be really awful. I suspect. I've done gigs where there's been, you've done the gigs like this, where sometimes it's just a hen night gig. So there's, you know, it's open to everybody, but it happens that at that weekend club in Liverpool, Manchester, Leicester, wherever, there are 200 women and 50 men, and it's hard work. And equally, I've done gigs where it's mostly men and it's hard work. I think what you want is a mix like this. So you want a mix of gender, you want a mix of age groups, you want a mix of backgrounds. And that to me is the best audience. So I think an audience of all women, I think it might work. It might be fun as an experiment, but I don't think it's something that I would do regularly.
I did that. Well, I mean, that doesn't really crop up ever on the circuit.
No.
I did an entirely female audience once on a television programme, of which some of you may have seen the first episode. It was weird. It was genuinely weird. It kind of worked.
Because it doesn't feel like it needs to be representative of what's outside, and it's odd if it's not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But nice question. Thank you, love.
Would you do a show like Jason Cook's? Go.
You mean like a sitcom? Yeah, telly. It's very harsh, isn't it? Go. No. There we go. Carry on. No. I might at some stage write a sitcom, but I'm not an actress. I'm awful. Can I tell you a tiny story?
Go on.
I went for an audition. I've only had two auditions ever for acting things. And the second one, the first one was bad. The second one, it was for a sketch show. And the person that I was to be playing opposite, I knew. So they said, oh, this is Mark. And he's changed his name really quickly. And he would be playing your boyfriend in this sketch, and you would be the girlfriend. Okay. And it was a sketch where you were... he was leaving, and I was begging him not to go. And I read it, because I can't do any other voices or accents or anything. And I read it and said, please don't go. And the director stepped in and went, no. You could drop to your knees. You know, if you want to cry, you could do that. And you think, this is a comedy sketch. It's not very bloody funny. And I leaned forward and I went, please don't go. And that was just, well, and she said, why aren't you putting more into it? And I said, oh, I don't really like her. And she said, what do you mean? I said, she's a doormat. And this is the problem. I'm not very good at doing something on stage or on telly or anything that I don't believe. I think everything I say on stage in my shows is, I would say 99% true. There might be tweaks for funny. Sometimes you change the wording slightly so that it gets a bigger laugh. But generally, everything I say has happened. And for me to then be this doormat of a woman, please don't leave me. Oh my God, I wanted to stab her in the eye. So I can't do it. So I think so I might write a sitcom for other amazing actors to be in it, but I don't think I'd ever be in a sitcom unless I was maybe, you know, like Alfred Hitchcock was like, he was always in the background. I could like rub benches in the background in a tabard. I might do that. So see if you can spot us.
Yeah, it would be lovely time to reveal you've been doing that for the last 5 years.
Yes, in all of the soaps.
Yeah.
Just occasionally looking at the camera.
What or who is the biggest influence in your comedy work?
And do you mean when I first started, or do you mean now?
Oh, both.
Both.
Oh, that's
a double question. I think you'll have one and fucking happy with that. sorry, I'm swearing a lot. I think when I first started, I hadn't really watched a lot of comedy, so I don't think I really saw somebody. I mean, I used to watch Victoria Wood and I adored Victoria Wood. So she was probably my best representation of a funny woman or a funny person. But I don't think I'm anything like her, so I don't think she influenced me in that way. She probably influenced me in that she made me laugh and I realised that it might be nice to make people laugh. But there was such a gap between watching her on the telly as a kid and starting stand-up at 29 that I don't think she was that influence. There's a woman called Kate Fox who is doing a Fringe called Good Breeding, a show at the Fringe called Good Breeding, who is the person who pushed me on a stage for the first time. So I think she is a massive influence and still is now, and I adore the woman. And probably now, you see, I came to the Fringe. One of the reasons I came to the Fringe is to be inspired. So I've seen two shows a day while I've been up here, and I am going to see like Tig Notaro and Janine Garofalo tonight. And I'm so excited about, because I'm constantly inspired. So I think every time I see a comedian that's doing something that I just think, God, do you ever get that where you think, I wish I'd written that? Why didn't I put that into such, you know, eloquent words? So I think I'm constantly inspired. And I think for the first part would be Kate Fox.
Out of your stand-up and your TV show, of which I have seen both, they are fantastic, by the way, which would you like to do if you could only do one forever?
I'm gonna flip it back to you. Which one do you like best?
Stand-up.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Next question. I don't know. I think is my life dependent on it?
No, but if you could, like, if somebody said you could only do.
Who was the person?
It sounded like Voldemort. I don't know who we've got in mind.
It's quite a posh person, and I don't respond well to posh people. If my life depended on it, I could do one. It would probably be stand up, because stand up is the thing that made me leave my job, the thing that resurrected me from a horrible divorce. It was the thing that made me feel like a person again, and I think I could never shun that.
Mm-hmm. Just something I wanted to bring up, because I listened to the episode that we'd recorded previously, and one of the things we were talking about was little life hacks, ways of dealing with things when you're on the road.
Yes.
One of yours was steaming a dress, putting it in the shower.
I was really surprised that you didn't know that. Everybody else knows that, don't they? Yeah, sorry, Stu.
Okay, well, that's all right. No. Lots of comics who'd listen to the thing.
Oh, really?
And emailed and said, oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Just anything to avoid ironing.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to show off to you that recently, me and Sasuke, my girlfriend, whilst we were in Sheffield in the hotel there, we managed to make pasta inside a kettle.
Oh, was it now? Okay,
We checked the kettle, because I remember your comments about kettles.
Oh, okay.
We checked it, cleaned it, boiled water in it. It was fine. And what we did was we got the orange bag that holds together clementines. You know, the orange net?
Yes.
If you buy Satsumas, you put... I love so many of you are like, this is amazing. And we put pasta inside it. It was tortelloni, so it was big enough to not go through the gaps. And we put it in there and you could boil it inside the kettle. Wham.
I've heard too many stories about men weighing in kettles.
I know you have, I know.
That I could never put pasta in. Although pasta's quite bland. It might give it a bit of something, mightn't it? Yeah. Like, oh, like, what have you added to this pasta, Stew? It's lovely.
Yeah.
Little bit of hotel room kettle.
We should move on.
It's a good tip, though.
I've got one more question. There's probably room for one more from the audience. How long did it take from your first gig to giving up work and going full-time as a comic? And what was that process?
Let's work it out. I started in September 2005. Where are we now?
2004.
Four. Thank you. God, it's good job he's here, isn't it? And my name is... So I think a little over a year, which I think is quite short for a lot of people, isn't it? Is that quite short? Is that usual?
I think that nowadays that's very unusual, yeah.
Because it was the December starting. After, like a year and a bit. So it was about a year and about 4 months that I decided. And somebody very smart said to me, it never feels safe. It always feels like a little bit of a leap of faith. And but I had signed to a brilliant agent who is still my agent now, and I knew that she sort of had my back and that she was, we're on it, we'll see how we get on. And I'd been doing as many gigs as I could, and I'd been working solidly, really. And
you smashed the competitions as well. You came first or second in pretty much all of them.
I came second three times and then finally won one. And
curse you, Tom Allen.
Tom Allen, I adore the man, but he is my comedy husband, because he came first twice when I came second. So I think that helped, because that helped me get an agent, because the agents will generally come to the you know, the finals of the competitions. And so I'd been working a lot, and I was only working part-time as well because I'd moved back in with my parents after getting divorced. So I was only working 25 hours a week in my proper job for most of that year and a bit. So I had a lot more time to spend on it. So I did work really hard on it, but then I think that is quite short, but it was slightly over about a year and 4 months, I think.
A lot of people ask comics about their advice for new comedians, but I wanted to ask, what would be your advice for comedians who've been going for a while? Comedians who've been going for 10 years. Stop. No. Comedians who've been going for a while but are finding it hard to break through to the next level.
See, I think it's different now, isn't it? Because when we started, I think it was easier. I think there were a lot more gigs around. I think persevere if you are getting good responses from audiences. Obviously, if you're not, so I know some people do it, and it's, you know, and you think, I don't know how you stop and go, I don't think it's going to work for me. I don't know how you do that, because I think most people who do comedy just have this drive and determination that they think, someday I'm keeping going. So I think it's about carrying on, and it's about constantly trying to get better. And I just think, don't give up. I think everything worth having is a bit of a fight.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. Please join me in thanking Sarah Millican.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Sarah. I think what struck me most about that interview, which we covered a lot of topics, and it felt like a very different interview to episode 7. I'm very pleased with that. But what struck me was how much energy she has for every aspect of the work of comedy. She's just a comic in whom everything matches up. Her skill, her talent, her industry, and her obvious love for the art and the craft of comedy. I could listen to her all day. That's all for now, though. More episodes coming up next week and beyond. Do get in touch if you'd like. Donate at www.comedianscomedian.com if you have the time and the funds and, of course, the inclination. No pressure. It's up to you. And finally, I'm just going to do the little audible plug now. So if you're familiar with this, you can switch off now. Are they gone? Right, just you left. Good. If you go to audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian and get a trial membership, then you get a free audiobook and I get a small kickback for your business. So it helps me whilst giving you a free thing. Today, I'm going to push Born Standing Up by Steve Martin. This has been mentioned by so many of my guests. And for Terry Alderton, remember last year, he mentioned it as the one book that really turned around his attitude towards comedy and his whole career. Even better, the audiobook version of Born Standing Up has Steve Martin himself reading it to you, which is just a fantastic way to enjoy it. So audible.co.uk/cc, and we're all winners. You get a free audiobook. You can cancel your subscription anytime you like, but you might find you enjoy having one. And I get a little something for the show. Thanks to Sarah. Thanks to James Lowy and to Nathan Wood, who co-produced this episode. Thank you, Nathan. That's all for now. Next week, someone else fantastic. Speak to you soon.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.